Ambulance dispatch for what town or city?
Edmonton.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
Okay, I'm 29 weeks pregnant and I feel like I'm going into labor. I'm having very, very, very intense contractions. I'm vomiting, I'm sweating.
Okay.
I'm shaking. I'm not sure what to do. I don't know if it's false labor.
Okay. How old are you?
31.
All right, so I do have paramedics on the way for you. I'm going to go through some questions, okay?
Okay, the door's locked. I need to get downstairs.
Okay. Can you see, feel, or touch any part of the baby now?
No.
Okay.
I haven't tried, but no.
Okay. Is this your first delivery?
No.
Okay. How many minutes apart are the contractions?
I'm honestly not sure. They're very close.
Okay.
Okay, between the next one, I'm going to go down and unlock the door.
Yeah.
So.
Just let me know when it stops, okay?
Okay. I think it's subsided.
Okay. Let me know if you have another one, okay?
Okay, so maybe I'm just going to go.
Yeah?
I've got my other kids here and my husband's out of town, so I'm just not sure.
Okay, not a problem. That's what we're here for.
Okay, the door's unlocked.
Okay.
Welcome to Caring Conversations, featuring the voices of those who care. With Brenda Blaze Nesbitt for caregiving.com.
Hello, everyone. Today I am joined by Liz LaHaye. Liz is a wife, a mom of three children, a volunteer and works full-time as an engineering technologist. Her youngest son, Frankie, who is 3 years old now, was born extremely prematurely at 26 weeks. She's going to share with us today what life is like raising a family, working full-time, and caring for her son, Frankie, who is diagnosed with spastic hemiplegia, a type of cerebral palsy. Welcome, Liz. I am so excited to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks, Brenda.
You're welcome. Let's start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Liz, and number one in life, of course, I am currently a mom, a full-time mom, as well as I do work full-time out of the house also. So as you could imagine, very, very busy.
Can you tell me, what does extremely prematurely mean? Because there is a difference, is there not, between premature and extremely premature?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So he's classified as a micro preemie. That's any baby that's born 24 weeks until about 30-ish weeks. Anything before 24 weeks is very unlikely to survive. Just to clarify, these are just my own perceptions and what I've learned with my life being in the medical field since Francis has been born. I have no medical background or anything, education or anything like that. He was 1 pound and 15 ounces when he was born. Yeah, he was just a little, little, tiny, tiny fella. He hardly looked like a baby. It was very, very unexpected and very, very traumatic for myself and for him, of course. Coincidentally, at that time, my husband was out of town work, which I was only, you know, just 6 months pregnant. So, of course, we had no thought of, in case baby comes, we had not even an inkling that that would even be a question. So him leaving town was completely fine. I was at home with my other two children around midnight. I was having some indigestion, some cramping. I wasn't really sure what was going on. And then I just immediately went into labor. It was instantaneous. And from that time of the cramping, indigestion starting at around midnight, he was born within about an hour and a half of that.
Wow.
So it happened very, very, very quickly. Yeah.
What did you do? You were home alone with two kids. What did you do?
Yeah, I was home alone with my two other children. I phoned my husband immediately and I said, something's not right. Something's wrong here. I don't know what it is. And then I was in labor, so crippled with pain, of course, contractions. I was literally crawling on the ground. And I said to him, I got to phone 911. I don't know what to do. So I phoned 911. I got a copy of that 911 call. It is oddly eerie how calm I was through the 911 call. I think it was just like, I don't know if it was like instinct or pain or whatever it was. The ambulance was there in 7 minutes, very, very fast. And they kept trying to coax me to come into the ambulance. We got to get you out. And I wouldn't leave. I was parked on my couch. I said, I cannot leave my other children. I just refused to leave. And the one paramedic looked at me and he said, it's going to be your life here. Like, do you want to be there for your kids? Like, you have to get out right now. I remember they helped me walk out. I don't even know what happened at that point. I was unsure what was happening with my other kids.
How old were they?
My oldest son, Vince, he was 10 and Maggie was 3.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, not old enough to fend for themselves yet. So I remember sitting down. It's very foggy, like the memory of this, but I remember just sitting down on the stretcher in the ambulance. And that was when my placenta ruptured. And from there, it got way more serious, I think, for not only myself, but for the paramedics that were involved. And we just went to the closest hospital here in Edmonton.
So what did happen with your kids?
A police officer and a social worker came and stayed with them. My husband was in Saskatoon, so he was quite far away. He was about a 6.5-hour drive. He started driving home in the middle of the night, knowing what was happening, obviously. So yeah, the police officer and social worker stayed with them until we were able to get a hold of a family friend to come over and kind of spell them off before my husband had gotten home.
Wow. Wow. So then what happened? You get to the hospital. And was it at the hospital that Frankie was born at, or was he born in the ambulance?
He was born at the hospital. We had just made it. They kept trying to tell me to wait, like just wait. But I remember like my body physically contracting. I couldn't not. He just kind of like came out. So he came out and he was, you know, you hear the term blue baby. He was not even blue. He was like dark, dark purple. Like it was, yeah. And again, I don't think I quite comprehended the severity of what was happening at the time. Like I was like, okay, where is he? Okay, I'll hand him over now. And they were like, oh no, like he's gone. And I'm, of course, shocked. What do you mean he's gone? And they had taken him. It was at the Misericordia Hospital here in Edmonton, which is actually not the hospital that micro premature babies are to be born at, just because of the lack of resources there. You think about a tiny baby, they need very special equipment, tiny equipment, really. So they pretty much had just got him stabilized and then took him over to the Royal Alexander, which is where the specialized NICU is.
Okay.
In Edmonton.
And you were at a different hospital. Your husband was at home with your children.
I just remember too, like, I got to get to him. I got to get to my baby. And they told me, no, you know, ma'am, you got to calm down. You got to have a BM. You got to get the bowels moving again. You got to walk around. And I'm like buzzing, like running around this hospital. I said, I don't care. Who do I need to talk to get out of this hospital so I can go and see my son? Whoever doctor it is, whatever manager, whatever nurse, let me talk to them because I will convince them to let me get out of here right now to go see my son. So he was born at about 2 a.m. I was discharged at 8 a.m. My husband came and picked me up and then we went, I didn't shower, I did nothing. I just went right over to that other hospital. And we weren't allowed to see him right away. He was very unstable. He did need a breathing tube put in. And from that, there's been long-term effects. Because he was so tiny and they didn't have the appropriate equipment at the hospital that we went to, his left lung was punctured at that time. And he still only has use of his right lung. His left lung is still severely damaged from that to this day and probably will be forever. So yeah, we just sat and waited. We didn't get to see him until later that afternoon. In the background, we still have the two other kids. So my mom had come from southern Alberta. So that was about a 7-hour drive for her. She came up to Edmonton and just kind of took everything on with the kids there. And pretty much my husband and I were just at the hospital for about the next 3 to 4 days. It was very, very touch and go. Again, looking back, I don't think I really realized that it was as life or death as it was. Speaking with the nurses, whom now being in the NICU for, we were in the NICU for 96 days in total, have become some of my really good friends. But just looking back and hearing the way that they speak about it, how sick he was very, very close to not making it. And I don't think I realized that at the time.
And I think that's probably shock and a coping mechanism that's you're not even aware of at that time.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's just so surreal. I can relate because I felt the same when my daughter was born as well. And you've already answered one of my questions, how long he was in NICU. How much did he weigh when you brought him home?
He was about 3.5 pounds. So still not even a typical baby weight. Looking at the pictures when he came home in that little car seat, is just a little nugget in the middle. He doesn't really even look like a full size. Well, he wasn't a full size baby at that time, but really he had tripled his birth weight when you put it that way. He was still not even wearing, he was wearing doll clothes, actually. We couldn't get clothes small enough for him.
How was that bringing him home after being in the NICU for so long?
Oh, it's so, as you use the word surreal, and I think that was perfect to explain that, because it became my life living in the NICU. In the whole 96 days, just over 3 months it was, I only missed one day of being there, and it was because I had mastitis, and I was like gravely ill myself, but it became my routine. Even on the weekends, it was my job to be there every single morning, get the kids ready for school. And I was there every single day, day in, day out, morning till night. I was there with him. So another thing you become dependent on, especially being in the NICU, is the monitors, the bells that go off, and just having that security, that comfort. So bringing him home was, yes, surreal, but also incredibly terrifying, because we didn't have that security blanket of, you know, the nurse, the monitors. They did let us do a 24-hour trial. So we brought him home once he was good, stable, off oxygen, all that. We did bring him home for one night just to try it out, to see how we would do and kind of set him up and stuff, which I'm very thankful for, because he had to go back for one more surgery before we were discharged in the end. But it was nice to just have him home and just get kind of like one foot in the door before we were just like sent off. Here you go on your own.
So you mentioned he had surgery. What did he have surgery for? You said one more surgery. So what were his surgeries for? How many did he have? As a tiny, I'm just imagining this tiny 1 to 3 pound baby having surgeries. That is pretty specialized care.
It's incredible. And the care, I mean, we can talk about how much I'm in love with the Stollery, because they've literally saved his life a number of times. But because of the birth trauma and the lack of oxygen that he got just after he was born, he has quite significant brain damage. 80% of the right side of his brain is damaged, and then about 50% of the left side of his brain. So a very large majority of his brain is damaged. Looking at his MRIs, I was like, why is it all white? I didn't understand what that means. And if anyone is familiar with looking at an MRI, white mass is dead mass, brain damage, really. I didn't quite get it. And then I just Googled, which is good and bad, Dr. Google, what a typical MRI looks like versus his. And I was like, whoa, that a lot of his brain is damaged. And in the end, Brenda, you've seen him, but his personality really covers a lot of that, because he's such a happy, lovely little fella. But so his first surgery, he had quite a bit of hydrocephalus. So with the brain damage, there was a blockage of the ability to drain the CFS fluid from his brain. And there was a lot of pressure and fluid buildup on his brain. So the first surgery, they were hopeful that he was not going to need a permanent intervention. It was just a temporary released. So what it was a reservoir put in on the top of his head, kind of like a bubble. And then they would just, with a needle, go through his skull into this reservoir that they put to drain the fluid and just pull the fluid out. And they were doing that daily to release the pressure on his brain in hopes that perhaps his body would be able to heal enough and then build some type of pathways to be able to drain this fluid. After about 2 weeks of that, of the draining of the fluid externally through the reservoir on the top of his head, his body was just not able to. He was, I mean, it's hard. He can't communicate, of course, but with his inflated heart rate, inability to breathe properly and stuff, ultimately he ended up getting a VP shunt of, I don't want to butcher this word, variventricular, I think is how it's pronounced. A shunt in the back of his head. And again, that's a permanent intervention. He's going to have that for the rest of his life. And they drill through the back of his skull and then into the middle of his brain to be able to drain the fluid permanently. And then there's a hose that goes from the back of his head around his neck and then over the front of his body and ultimately landing or ending in his abdomen where the excess fluid drains. So he has an excess of wet diapers, if that kind of just how it flows out of him, because it's not done naturally. So he had two neurosurgeries or brain surgeries before the 96 days. And then he also had a double inguinal hernia repair, which is on his abdomen and testicles, because again, he was just not developed enough.
And the shunt, you said that it's at the back of the brain and then goes through a tube down into his stomach. And that's all internal.
It's all internal.
So when people who don't know what shunts are, they don't want to visualize this as something external to the body. It's all implanted in the body.
Right.
Yeah. So for someone who says she has no medical background, 3 years later, you're speaking medical speak here and you seem to know a lot. You've learned a lot in Frankie's 3 years.
That's right. Yes, exactly. I feel like I could be like an RN or something.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I think most parents with complex kids could feel the same way. So tell me, when did you know that Frankie was diagnosed with spastic hemiplegia, which is, and I might want to add that in layman's terms, it is a form of CP, cerebral palsy. How soon did you find out that diagnosis, or was it something they were preparing you for from the very beginning because he was so premature?
So cerebral palsy is something that was loosely thrown around bedside in the NICU. Cerebral palsy is common just because of the amount of children that they see that are premature. Unfortunately, it wasn't, in my opinion, communicated to us appropriately. I was really quite conservative and reserved and kept my composure very well being in the NICU. And I think to that was a little bit to my detriment because of how comfortable the nurses and doctors were with, oh yeah, he's going to have CP, but he's going to be fine. And I think that just being thrown out to us carelessly, honestly, in my opinion, looking back at it, it was not done properly. In my opinion, it was told at the bedside. And after, again, you know, making friends with a lot of the nurses and a lot of the other caregivers and parents within the NICU, they had these parent meetings where that they would take the parents and the medical team into a private room, have a social worker there to support and communicate properly. Sometimes they do a parent advisor in there to ensure things are done properly. We never had one of those meetings. Everything was told to us at the bedside. So after learning of these meetings afterwards, and with my volunteer experience now being a parent advisor for a family similar to myself, I do advocate for those types of meetings and how important they are in someone's life and their future. Like that was a forever statement in my head that will never, ever be gone. And it's my child, it's my entire life now that was affected by that one statement, you know? So yeah, we did have an idea. I mean, severity, we had no idea, but we were loosely told that he was going to have cerebral palsy from the time that he was tiny in the NICU. The official diagnosis took until he was about two, one and a half-ish is when they started the testing. He never really had a lot of use of his left hand and arm at all. So that was a key indicator for us, kind of just watching him grow, even being 4 months, 6 months, 8 months old. And we also didn't really realize the impact it would have on the rest of his body either. His legs don't bear weight to this day. He will never walk recreationally, that he was going to have a cerebral palsy diagnosis at some point. Yeah.
So was it the fact that he wasn't reaching certain developmental milestones that the doctors started to question whether they should test, or was it just automatic testing that they knew that they would do at that age?
It ended up being automatic testing just because of the significance of his brain damage and because of the complicated medical history with the VP shunt and the lung damage and things like that. We were very well taken care of and streamlined through that process. Because of his complexity, I feel like we were very well taken care of and made sure that we were contacted at 3 months, at 6 months. They were doing testing often for him.
So Liz, you mentioned the experience in the NICU and just the loose term of cerebral palsy and not having that official family meeting. And it took me back to my days when my daughter was born as well. And I remember a resident coming to me and saying, well, there's no brain activity. And she was, I don't know, 2 days old. And then it took another couple of days for me to actually speak with the consultant. And he said, we don't anticipate there'll be any issues. We'll do a CT scan when she's 2 weeks old. But I don't anticipate that she will have any problems at all. And she was actually 5 days late. She wasn't breathing when she was born, though. So he said 85% of the time he was right, and 15% of the time he was wrong. So I tried to get him to touch on that. Okay, so what if you're in that 15%? He wouldn't let me go there. So I pushed further, and I said, well, I have a brother with cerebral palsy. Could it be anything like that? No, don't go there. Don't go there. I'm sure she'll be fine. I was trying to get them to talk about it. They were loosely talking about it with you. But I think, you know, when you said they just kind of throw it around that he may have CP, he'll be fine. I think it's easy for those health professionals to, because you, like you said, they live this every day. And they care for these babies, these sick babies every day, and they see the outcomes. But they also get to go home at the end of their shift. And they don't have to go home and live with this child and bring that child up through, you know, not meeting all of those developmental milestones. Everybody has different personalities and has different coping mechanisms. When you said that you stayed calm and strong and didn't show your emotions during that time, I was the exact same. I was scared to show my emotions. Now I know that showing my emotions can also be a strength. But it reminds me of a quote. I've heard it. I don't have it right in front of me. But it goes something like this. Just because we're carrying it well doesn't mean it's not heavy. And I think that health professionals need to be reminded of that. Some parents might crumble and some parents might not crumble in front of you, but they're always going to crumble. And it's just a matter of having that same sensitivity to every parent. What it comes down to is sensitivity. So you've told us a lot about Frankie. You said he's spastic hemiplegia. So tell the listeners what that means exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it pretty much means that half of your body is paralyzed. With him, the hemi being half. With him, it's both of his legs and his left arm. So it's three limbs out of four. And then spastic end means very, very tight or spastic muscles. He does not have muscle control and they're very, very tight and engaged all the time. So example would be ballerina toes. He pretty much has ballerina toes, his feet, toes, and legs pointed all the time. That's obviously a lot of work for your muscles. He's very tired a lot of the time. And then for his body to relax those muscles, it takes extra effort for him to even be able to relax them, let alone use them efficiently or effectively. One treatment that we do often with him is Botox injections to relax the muscles, even to just be able to get his braces on, or for him to be able to, something as simple as gripping something just to relax those muscles so that he's able to control his hand a little bit. He doesn't have a lot of control of his hand or his fingers, but post Botox, we do intensive therapy. It's called CMIT, Constraint Induced Movement Therapy. And it's an intensive therapy that lasts 6 weeks, and it's 3 times a week. He works with an occupational therapist to just get those muscles moving, hoping to gain some muscle memory. However, as he's growing and as the Botox injections wear off, it does just kind of revert back to the extreme spasticity, inability to wear braces, inability to control his muscles. And he's just extremely uncomfortable most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about your other children. How have they adapted to having Frank, his little brother, and to this world of disability? It was sudden for mm-hmm. you. It had to have been very sudden and scary for them at such young ages.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I had said, I lived at the hospital there for 3 months. So I was really quite absent with my other kids. Thankfully, my husband is amazing and very supportive and domesticated and was really great at home. But my daughter, especially, she's 3, or was 3 at the time, even to this day, now she's 6 or going to be 7. Our entire family has actually physically been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress, because of how traumatic that event was. And then mom was gone for 3 months, really. And anytime Francis, you know, gets a sniffle or is a tiny bit sick, like Maggie's like, is he going to the hospital? Or here, I'll get the bag ready. Like, she just goes into like fight or flight mode herself, being 6 years old. You know, it's heartbreaking for me as a mom to see. However, the care and compassion and thoughtfulness that she has for Francis is just second to none. It's just wonderful. Yeah. And then my now 13-year-old, again, he was 10 at the time. He was a little bit embarrassed, I think. Even, you know, when we pull up, we've got the handicap sticker on the car and we've got the wheelchair in the back now and stuff. But thankfully, we have a very wonderful support system of close friends and family around here. And they're very open that, you know, they'll help move the wheelchair. One of our friends made a ramp to get up into the house so Frankie could come over for Thanksgiving dinner. And
oh, that's amazing.
And yeah, it's really quite nice. Both of the kids have had a really hard time with it. And, you know, Francis does get the majority of the parenting time. We do make sure both my husband and I have individual time with each kid to make sure that we, you know, still fill their tanks. It's not just all about Francis all the time. We do have right now an in-home caregiver, full-time caregiver for Francis. So that also helps too, that he has specific care for him so that I can go out and take Maggie to the farmer's market or go to a hockey game with Vince or something like that. We do have full-time care and then also respite in the evenings and weekends too. So we make sure to utilize those services as much as we can also. And it's really important for us to have family time with and without Francis, because our world really does revolve around him in a good and bad way, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, that's really good. You've answered already some of the questions I had just in that. So thank you. It is really tough for siblings, I know. And to get that one-on-one attention from their parents is really vital as well. They need to know that they're important as well. What do you and your husband do to make sure that your marriage stays strong during mm-hmm. all of this?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting and really good question, because, I mean, not to mention a global pandemic happening that kind of puts a wrench in things also. But we do the same. We're very deliberate, and we really intentionally make time for each other. One thing just recently, like, I have my core group of girlfriends that I have as my support system. And for Vince, my husband, he doesn't really have that as much. His friends, it's not that they're not supportive. I just think they're just kind of out of sight, out of mind, don't really ask, don't really want to know kind of thing. So he has reached out. He's got, you know, good support with his brother and stuff. But I said to him, there are lots of support groups. There's dad special needs support groups that, you know, would be really important and good for him to be a part of, because I don't mind supporting him. And I think that's absolutely necessary to lean on each other. However, it also is important to have a sounding board externally. So he's done really good. He's joined a couple of committees. He joined a accessibility committee with the city of Edmonton. So that's kind of an outlet for him. He does some volunteering with the city. And then he has found some support groups also. And I should say both my husband and I have done in the past and are open to, you know, long-term therapy, having a psychologist that we speak to about the trauma, you know, ongoing issues with Francis and our family and things like that. And I think normalizing therapy, not only for children in a physical sense, but in a mental health sense, is also really important to put out there too.
I really like how you said normalizing therapy, because it can be such a stigma. Parents of children with special needs or disabilities or going through illnesses can already be dealing with a lot of stigma as it is. And to add the fact that some of them might be embarrassed to say, I'm seeking therapy for my own emotional health, my own mental health, adds to that stigma. But I absolutely believe it is one of the supports that every parent out there needs. Unfortunately, it's not financially possible for every parent unless they're involved with a rehab treatment center that might offer it as part of their services. Here in Canada, we're very fortunate that we don't have to pay for healthcare. We do in other ways through our taxes, but not like in the US. And a lot of those services are just not financially feasible on top of the costs of caring for a child with disabilities. But it is vitally important because, like you said, to get through the trauma, to help your child through the trauma, other children through the trauma, and also to help go through transitions you will inevitably end up going through. So I'm glad that you use that term, normalizing therapy. It's really important for us to embrace that our mental health is extremely important. We've talked a lot about Frankie's disability. Let's talk about Frankie. Tell me about Frankie outside of his disability.
Right.
What is he like? You said he's happy.
Oh, he is. He's quite happy. He is. If I had to sum him up in one word, it would be determined. Oh. He is so damn determined, that boy. He army crawls, right? Because he's only has use of his right arm. So he will army crawl and get across that floor to get, well, an iPhone. But he's so, so, so determined. Even, you know, as being a parent and watching him eat. Here's an example. It's painful because it's messy and he's shaking and he can't control his arms, and he will get through that bowl of oatmeal. Like, it takes him half an hour and he's got oatmeal from head to toe, but he will get through that oatmeal because that's what he wants to do when he's hungry. He is so, so, so determined.
Yeah, he's doing it himself.
That's right, and he's doing it on his own. Yeah. Yeah, and he'll tell you, get lost. I got this. Like, let me do it. And he's really cheeky and sassy, which is really interesting to see his personality develop, because as children develop, it's always interesting to see different pieces of them come out. But he's got quite a little sense of humor. And for him, he was thought to be, he's going to be nonverbal and not be able to speak. And for now, you know, to see him flourish and get in on the jokes and giggle and laugh and be cheeky and wear silly hats. And like, he lights up the room. All of our therapists and family and everyone that sees him are just obsessed with him. He's just a lovely little fella. He has a little friend, Jalen is her name. And she says, Frankie's my boyfriend. And she'll come. It is the cutest thing. She holds his hand in his wheelchair and she knows not to go to the left side because he can't use his left arm. She'll walk around and go to the right side of his wheelchair and hold his hand. It's so cute.
Oh my God. Okay, full disclosure to everybody. Full disclosure, Jalen is my great niece.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so adorable. And I've seen videos and pictures of Frankie, and his talking is unreal. Like, it's awesome.
Yes.
It's awesome. And he is very cute. That's awesome. So you've mentioned all the supports that Frankie's received. Has he had a lot of hospitalizations since those first few months?
Mm-hmm. So with the VP shunt that we mentioned, he does have a very high rate of failure. So he has had a number of shunts fail, two of which have needed revisions. So in total, he's gone through 4 neural surgeries. And then also with his lung, so his left lung being punctured and not fully functioning, his respiratory system is just not very strong and his immunity is quite low in general. He's had pneumonia a number of times, so we've been hospitalized for that. He's on seizure watch and he's had a number of seizures in his life. We've had absolutely our fair share of hospital stays. The Stollery staff knows us all by name, but very, very strong support from the Stollery. But yes, we've had a number of hospitalizations.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say they were like overall? Do you typically go to the Stollery? That is in Edmonton. It's the big children's hospital there. Do you typically go there for all of his admissions?
Yeah, we do. One time he just had a large bug bite that he reacted to, and we took him to just a typical walk-in GP. It was just a skin rash. There was no other respiratory distress, nothing to do with his brain, his legs, but a GP sees a 3-year-old in a wheelchair and they run the other way. They don't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. And they ended up just sending us to the Stollery anyway for a bug bite. So we do, just because of his complexity, even if it is something as simple as a rash or pink eye or whatever, a lot of doctors just, they won't even touch him. So yes, unfortunately, we do have to go to the Stollery pretty much for any care. And with that being said, he is on a very strict no travel order just because of his volatility with his shunt and with his breathing and stuff. So we're to stay within 1 hour perimeter of Edmonton at all times, just in case. So that really puts a cap on any type of family vacations and things.
Yeah. Yeah, that must be difficult. I mean, not so difficult in the last year and a half with COVID, but outside of that, it might prove to be difficult in the future for sure. So what do you do, Liz, to stay upright?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's an interesting question because people always say, like, how do you do it?
Yeah.
How do you stay so strong? How do you keep going? How do you stay so strong? And my answer to that is, well, what else am I going to do? Not do it? Not be a mom, not keep going, not like, no, you find that strength and you just, hey, don't get me wrong. I have my shower cries. I, you know, indulge on the weekends and drink a little too much wine, you know, like that. It's just all part of the cycle. But for me, what keeps me going is the smile, is the kids, is seeing the big and small wins. And accomplishments, not only with Francis, but with all my kids, and also the support of my husband. He's just such a lovely man. He's a very, very kind and compassionate fella. And we wouldn't be able to do and have this family without each other. So that's what keeps me going, is the smiles on the faces and my husband, for sure.
That's awesome. You know, I get that question a lot too. Like, how do you do it? I've been doing it for 28 years now. How do you keep going? And what I like to tell people, because that's a tough question to answer, we have this resolve that as parents, we just do for our kids what we need to do. And I use the example of, if you saw your child in harm's way, like perhaps a truck barreling towards them, what would you do? Would you race to your child and grab them so that they didn't get hit? Of course you would. And I think that sums up what we do for our children. We see them hurting or we see them in harm's way and we do everything we can to save them from that. Unfortunately, we have to watch them go through some really, really difficult times like you have with Frankie. And it's tough because we are trying to protect them from being hurt. But in order to get better, we have to allow others to subject them to some pain that will have a greater good for them. So it's a really tough internal conflict we have as parents. And I think the other thing that gets me through is just never-ending hope. And yeah. Every time you see that smile on your child's face, and like you said, even a small win, that is a glimmer of hope for you.
Absolutely agree.
And what do you do for yourself, Liz?
Yeah, that is a tough one. I'm intentional about my time, my me time, if you will. I do girls trips twice a year. I've got two different groups of girlfriends that I ensure, and that'll keep me going. That's something to look forward to and to do. And again, Brenda's niece is one of my really good friends, and we go for bike rides, like even just a late night bike ride. Like, I just make sure that I decompress myself. Other than that, really, that's it. I don't, like, I do a lot of outdoor stuff. I do a lot of hiking, but I just am really intentional about my me time. I took a week off the end of May, and I went camping by myself, and wow. It was glorious. That's it was wonderful. Awesome. My kids came for a day or two, and we went golfing and stuff, but the evenings were on my own. I had a fire in the river valley by myself and just recharged my own batteries. And I feel like that makes me a better mom and a better in all aspects, work and everything, right? It's just really important to be intentional about your recharge time.
Yeah. And it has to be something that brings you peace and brings you joy and does recharge yes. you. So maybe camping won't be the answer for someone. Perhaps going to a hotel will be the answer for someone else. And perhaps they might not be able to get away for a week. But for me, I always have care staff to help me in the morning with my daughter. So I can get up and I can take care of me. That never used to be the way. It was always take care of my daughter first and then me. But now I've been really intentional about having that care so that I can take care of me and get myself ready and charged up for the day. Do you have any motivational songs or quotes that you go to when you're feeling particularly challenged that keep you going?
There's a quote, it's something to the effect of, you don't know how strong you are until you have no other choice. And that kind of goes full circle with how do you do it? And it's like, yeah, I can acknowledge my strength. I can acknowledge my ability and resilience to keep going and that I am a good mom. And I do a lot of the time put my kids first. There's nothing specific. I would say I have some kind of the opposite, like some sad songs or things that bring me back to, you know, when Frances was in the NICU and things like that. But for me, it's just keep going. Like I said, I do read inspirational message boards. I'm part of a cerebral palsy group. So that kind of, and it's an intentional, like uplifting one. It's not kind of more, you know, about the diagnosis and the troubles. It's about, like we said, the small wins and the goods of disability and things like that. I would say another thing I do to kind of motivate myself would be to give back and to volunteer. I love being a part of the Parent Advisory Committee at the Stollery Children's Hospital, and I do a lot of work with and for them. And that really recharges me and motivates me to keep going to seeing other families that need the support and the help, and just, yeah, helping wherever I can that way too helps me keep going.
You're giving to them what you wish you had.
That's right, exactly.
And you know exactly what they're going through because you've gone through it, and that's such a value to those families. And I'm sure that fills that space for you to feel like you've helped someone and maybe you've made their journey a little bit easier. That's awesome that you do that, Liz. That's really awesome. Liz, your time in the hospital, what would you say is what do parents need the most when their child is in the hospital?
You know, something for me, what was very, very helpful, and this came from my workplace that I was working at the time, was they sent a big package of frozen pre-made meals. It helped us, like they sent, I don't even know, 10 or 12 meals, pre-made, put it in the oven, done. It was so, so helpful. It just takes one more stress out of, and then you're not eating fast food and whatever. So that was one major helpful, thoughtful thing that got done for us. It also is a little bit of a financial free, right? Like it gives you a meal for you and your family. So I would absolutely recommend if someone's in the hospital, give them food.
Yes,
that's a
yes.
Really wonderful thing.
There's a lot of things that others can do for families who have children in the hospital. One thing is providing meals.
Yeah.
People have no idea how much money it costs to have your child in the hospital if you don't have time to take a meal with you, or you don't have time to grocery shop, to make meals, to take with you while you're there all day, every day. Then it's helpful to have meals dropped off. It's helpful to have gift certificates for restaurants that might be close by. Even I know the hospital that we frequent, they have dining cards that can be used in the cafeteria. So you can gift someone with a dining card. I know someone else whose work paid for their parking for a month. Parking costs are really high.
Yes.
So lots of things that can be done, helping with yard work, helping with pet care, helping with care for your other children, making sure their needs are met as well. All of those things can be really helpful for those outsiders looking in that don't know what to do. There's a lot they can do. What would you say you need the most from the health professionals in the hospital?
That's kind of a loaded question. So one thing that I do is I do orientations for the new nurses that are going into the NICU. And with that, I am emotional as I go through. We talked about this in the beginning, but how almost robotic nurses are or need to be, not only nurses, doctors, just staff in general, because it's just, you know, it's their job and that's kind of the way they have to be. So I think the biggest thing is compassion and understanding without judgment is a really, really important piece for a healthcare professional to be aware of. Everyone's stories are different. And within that orientation that I do, we talk about families that aren't able to be at the hospital, and don't judge them because, you know, mom, you don't know if grandma's dying of cancer or has 17 kids at home, or maybe she flew in from, you know, a territory or something. You just be understanding, compassionate, and non-judgmental as much as you can when it comes to everyone's individual situations.
Absolutely. 100%. I think the other thing I would add to that is that to trust the mother's gut instincts, because they might have the medical background, but we have our child's background. And we know in our guts, especially for those who can't communicate, infants, children who can't speak, we get to read our children in a way that no medical professional is ever taught, because everybody is so unique. I think that's another really important thing for health professionals to respect.
Yeah.
Liz, when you think about everybody on Frankie's team, his health team when he's in the hospital, his team at home, his team with his rehab treatments, who's the most important person on that team besides Frankie himself?
Of course. I would have to say it's me and my husband. We are his number one fans. We are always here to push and support him. And it's got to be us. We are his number one advocates. And like you said, know him best and know his boundaries and limits. And we are absolutely the most important.
Yeah. If there's one thing you could share with a new family, and I know you've been doing this already as an advisor, a parent advisor for Stollery. What is the one thing you could share that you think would help a new family?
Mm-hmm. Embrace the ebbs and flows. There's going to be bad times. There's going to be terrible times. There's going to be hopeless times that you feel it's not going to end. That's just, unfortunately, it's just part of it. But embrace that, the downs, and then celebrate and embrace the ups. just know that it's going to get better every time. As terrible and down in the dumps as it does get, it does get better. Just know that, as you said, Brenda, there's hope and it ebbs and flows. Know that the ride the wave, that's what we say around here. Embrace the wave. We're on a low right now and it's going to get better.
And I think it's important to instill in them that it's okay to ask for help.
Yes.
That's the only way we can get through it, is to have those support systems. Like you said, you have support systems within the system. You have support systems within your own personal lives and your families. It's okay to ask for help. So tell me, what is going on with Frankie now? He's 3, almost 4. What are the next steps in his life?
Frankie's next steps. So he endures Botox treatments every 4 to 6-ish months. So that's going to be an ongoing treatment for him. We have been currently accepted into the GRIT program here in Alberta. It's called Getting Ready for Inclusion Today is what that stands for.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yes. So exciting. It was quite a process to get the intake done and stuff, but completely worth it. And what it is, it's a team of one teacher, one educational assistant, an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, and a speech language pathologist that come into your house, and they do a preschool type program in home for him. And then with that, from the socialization standpoint, they support all community programming. So they'll do, whether it be a library group or a craft group at a community center or a swim group or whatever, they do an inclusive community program once a week.
That sounds amazing.
I'm very excited. Francis is very excited. He got to meet his teacher over Skype and saw a video of her and stuff. So he's really, really excited. He's such a social little guy. So I think he's going to do awesome with that.
Yes, that sounds amazing. And with COVID-19 in our lives right now, it sounds like the best way to keep him involved, but yet to keep him safe as can be.
That's right. Exactly.
Awesome.
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to share with us today before we wrap up?
I just want to thank you, Brenda, and thank caregiving.com for this opportunity to get our voice out and tell Frankie and our story. And I hope we gave someone some hope or some information or an inkling of something today. And I'm so honored and happy to be here. And to have you as a support and a friend too, Brenda. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Liz. You know, you've shared so much insight and wisdom and hope with us today. And I hope that everyone can take away something from it. Parents, those supporting those families of children with disabilities, and also health professionals. Because we're focusing on the season of families with children with disabilities, can you tell me the one thing you want others to take away from this conversation?
I would say just never, never give up. Keep advocating. As many roadblocks and walls and Debbie Downers that you encounter, never give up. Keep pushing, keep going for your children. Be that number one fan, be that advocate and voice that needs to be voiced for them. Keep going. Never give up.
I agree. That's a great way to sum this up, Liz. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you being with us today. It's been such a pleasure. And I want to wish you and Frankie and all of your family all the very best to come.
Thank you very much. And to you and Nikki also.
Thank you for listening to Caring Conversations, proudly sponsored by Coaching for Caregivers Canada. For more information about the podcast, resources, and how to reach out to Brenda or our guests, we welcome you to visit caregiving.com/caringconversations or find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.